Hare Krishna. So welcome back to the second session. And I know you have some questions. We will, after each session, we will have some time for questions. And maybe one of the last sessions, either today or tomorrow, we can devote fully to question answers. But let's move forward with, with the session right now. And if you have some questions, please note them down so that we can discuss them in due course. We will have time for question answers, probably in one session, one whole session tomorrow can be for question answers. So I discussed in the previous session about what makes us unconscious. It is our mind which is meant to be connect us with the outer world, but the mind makes us caught in its in thoughts which pop up within itself, and that makes us unconscious of important things or physical reality, and we get caught in the mental level. When this happens, what particularly catches our attention, that may depend on the impressions within the mind, which are of two types, instincts and impulses. So we will use this framework of analysis to look at certain characters in the Mahabharata. So let's start with the character of Dhritarashtra. The word Dhritarashtra itself means Dhrita Rashtra. Rashtra is kingdom. Dhrita is to hold. So this name can have both a positive and a negative connotation. The negative connotation is one who is very attached to the kingdom. One who holds on to the kingdom. So in Indian politics, if some politician is very old and nearing retirement and still that politician wants to hold on to the post, that person, politicians are criticized. You are being like Dhritarashtra. So Dhritarashtra, usually the word has the negative connotation. But that is not the only connotation. So why would anyone, any parent, give a child a name with a negative connotation? So Dhritarashtra also has a meaning that Dhritarashtra. Dhrita means to dhri, sustain. So one who sustains the kingdom. So it can refer to one who holds on to the kingdom or one who holds the kingdom. That means one who keeps the kingdom together, one who sustains the kingdom. So both meanings are there. Now Dhritarashtra, we see that he is a person who is in many ways a tragic figure in the Mahabharata. He's born in a royal family, but because of fate, he ends up being blind, and for a Kshatriya to have a Kshatriyas, everybody needs their body to function, but Kshatriyas especially need a very well functional body because they are guardians, they are martial guardians of society, so they often have to fight. So when he is born blind, it is decided that he can't become the next king. So after that, his younger brother Pandu is born and he becomes the king. So normally the oldest son becomes the heir, becomes the next king. So because Dhritarashtra at one level felt entitled to the kingdom, and at another level he felt he was deprived of the kingdom. So because of this, his life constantly goes on in vain desires. Vain desires means desires which are just pointless. Now, desiring is a natural faculty of the human being. But our desires are not always in productive directions. That means if something has happened in the past, say we made a mistake or somebody did something, now that has already happened and that is over. So we can't do anything about it now. So if we keep lamenting what has happened in the past, that is a vain battle. The battle that is in front of us is the battle that we can fight. But if we keep lamenting over something that has happened in the past, then that is a pointless battle. It's like fighting a battle that is already lost. Suppose, say, India fought with China in 1961 and India lost. And if people, Indians, are keep thinking, oh, we should have fought and we should have won, we should have done like this, we should have done like that. Or sometimes, say, a cricket match is played and say, India loses the cricket match. You know, this batsman, he should have batted like this, he should have bowled like this, you know, this batsman should have come before. Well, it's over now. That match is over. So, there is we can learn from the past. That is very different from lamenting about the past, and that is very different from living in the past. So, some battles are just over. So, for Dhritarashtra, the fact that he couldn't be the king, or at least not a full king, the way a king was expected to be, that was something which he just needed to accept. At one level, from this life's perspective, life is not fair to anyone. Life, we understand from a multi-life perspective, we all have done some karma because of which you get certain results. From this life's perspective, life is just unfair. And we have to get used to it. So sometimes we may fall sick for no apparent reason. Sometimes some relationship misunderstanding may happen because of no apparent reason. Sometimes, you know, we might just get fired. 10 people in the company get fired. But which 10 about 1,000? You know, it might just, you know, why does the 10 get fired? There might not be any specific logical reasons. It just happens. So in many ways, life is not fair. So this is something which we just have to get used to. If one doesn't get used to that, then one keeps projecting desires, which are projecting desires, just keeping hoping this will happen, this will happen, this will happen. No, that's not going to happen. Just because one thing has gone wrong doesn't mean everything is going to go wrong. And it doesn't mean that we have to keep trying to set that right. Dhritarashtra always had the desire, I want to be the king. It's not a wrong desire. He was born in the royal dynasty. He was the eldest son. But in that particular situation, that was not going to happen. And he was never disrespected or deprived. He was given all royal comforts. But because the desire was there so strong within him, eventually he thought that if I don't become the king, my son will become the king. And it seemed overall as if his son was set to become the king. Because Pandu retired to the forest, and Pandu had a curse because of which if he tried to beget children, he would die. So it was now thought that he will not have children. Therefore, Dhritarashtra's son will become the next king. But Pandu, he did get the Pandavas through the gods. And then when Pandu passed away in the forest, at that time the Pandavas came back. So Dhritarashtra had been growing up Duryodhana with the hope that Duryodhana will become the next king. In fact, when Duryodhana was born, at that time the Mahabharata described there were inauspicious signs everywhere. When Krishna is born, Krishna appears in this world, at that time the whole universe was auspicious. But when Duryodhana was born, it said storms were happening and then jackals were braying and all kinds of inauspicious signs. And in a sense, Dhritarashtra had 100 sons through some mystical means. And there's one fetus from which 100 were born. So the difference in age between the 100 was not much. And it was clear that he was going to have 100. So Vidura told him that, you know, this son is going to be the cause of inauspiciousness for you. He says, give him up. Abandon him. Leave him. You will still have many other sons. He says, no, he's my son. How can I leave him? And at one level, his reasoning is true. And how can a parent abandon a son? But at the same time, he is not just an ordinary parent. He's a king. And his son is going to become the next king. So for him, he has to consider not just his attachment to his son, he has to consider his responsibility as a member of the royal family. And that's why, you know, the more the social positions that we are in, the more is expected from us. We can't just act. If somebody is just a single person, they can, I want to go here, I'll go here. I want to watch that, I want to watch that. I will do this, I'll do that. But if somebody is in the family, you think, okay, if I do this, what is going to affect on my partner, on my children. I have to think about other things. If somebody in a bigger position, they have to think much more. So Dhritarashtra, he was almost throughout his life, he was almost never conscious of his royal responsibilities. His consciousness was caught in his son. And his son becoming the next king. Because of that, he did not think about his other responsibilities. Like earlier, I talked at a sensory level. You know, from the different senses, different inputs keep coming in. And we have to know which to focus on. Now, when we are driving a car, at one point, in one sense, we have to focus on the road ahead. But then we also have to be aware of what is going on way ahead. If way ahead, the cars are showing, their rear light is becoming red or the cars are slowing down, then we have to press the brake right now so that we slow down. So there is a focus on the immediate, but we cannot just be aware only of the immediate. There is, our consciousness is capable of being aware of multiple things. Now there is what you can say primary awareness or foreground awareness. But along with the foreground awareness, there is background awareness. So right now, say you are hearing what I am speaking. But then you may become conscious, you know, okay, this is too hot, or maybe this is too cold. Maybe the way I am sitting is comfortable, it's not so comfortable. So these are all thoughts that are there. And they will be at the background of our awareness. Sometimes it just becomes unbearably cold or unbearably hot. Then we may have to take some action. So just as we have something in the foreground and something in the background. Similarly for us, in our day-to-day life, the same applies with respect to our various roles and our relationships. For Dhritarashtra, so if you consider the windows, Dhritarashtra for him, just the window of Duryodhana was all that was open on his inner screen. And all other windows were closed. They just pop up temporarily, but they would minimize. This would very soon dominate the inner screen. So he saw everything through the filter of Duryodhana's pleasure or displeasure. Duryodhana's gain or loss. It was not even his own gain. Because he lost reputation, he lost standing by being so attached to his son. But he became desensitized, as I said, to his royal responsibilities, even to his extended family responsibilities. When Pandu passed away, at that time, Dhritarashtra became like the surrogate father of the Pandavas. In extended families, that is how if some person passes away, the other family members take care of the children. And that's what the sages, when Pandu passed away in the forest, the sages told Kunti that now you should go back to the kingdom. And because her sons were born in a mystical way, so if some questions were raised about that, were they really Pandu's sons, the sages said, we will come with you. And we will testify, because Pandu had consulted the sages before. And the sages had said, yes, you are a king, it is important for you to have sons. So you can have sons through the gods. And so when they came back, at that time, the sages testified that these are actually Pandu's sons. And then, for them there was no father. So at one level, because the sages had testified, everybody accepted that these are Pandu's sons. But intermittently, Duryodhana or somebody else would cast aspersions. Now, are you really parts of our dynasty? Not very often, but that aspersion would come intermittently. However, once they were accepted more or less that they are the sons of the Pandu and they are members of our dynasty, then it was Dhritarashtra's responsibility as the main father figure in their family to care for him. Now, Bhishma was the grandfather, and Bhishma practically became like a father for the Pandavas. Because Dhritarashtra was so lost in his own world, so attached to his son, that he just couldn't think of anything else. So in one sense, if you look throughout the life, it was the Pandavas who offered Dhritarashtra more respect than Duryodhana. But Dhritarashtra was so attached that he was concerned only about the pleasure of Duryodhana, and he was not concerned what to speak of the pleasure, but even the survival of the Pandavas. This is how attachment blinds us. So the theme, when analyzing the characteristic of, character of Duryodhana, of each character, I will have one theme. So while analyzing the character of Dhritarashtra, the theme I'm taking is wrongdoing is not just the wrong that we do, it is also the right that we don't do. Wrongdoing is not just the wrong that we do, it is also the right that we don't do. So, in one sense, if a thief robs a bank, a thief is a wrongdoer. But if there is a security in charge, a security person, a police or someone who is there, and the police does nothing, the police may say, I did not rob the bank. Yeah, you did not rob the bank, but you did not stop the bank from being robbed. And if an ordinary citizen doesn't stop, well, ordinary citizen is not expected to. If they do, they are going beyond their duty and they are serving the nation, serving the community. That's great. But a person who is a maintainer of the law, security in charge, or say a security person, they have to act. That's their duty. That's what they are paid for. That's what is expected from them. So if they don't do it, then that is also wrong. So wrongdoing is not just the wrong that we do, but also the right that we don't do. In the Dhruva Maharaj pastime, it was Suruchi who actually did the wrong. She pushed Dhruva from the lap of his father, Uttanapada. So she did the wrong. Now Uttanapada did not do anything. But in not doing anything, he did a wrong. Because his son expected his support. His son expected his protection. And in general, we all have different expectations from different people. So the Pandavas understood, and everybody understood, the Pandavas and Kauravas would be natural rivals. They are the same generation, more or less of the same age. So rivalry, and sometimes the rivalry can become escalated. That is natural. But Dhritarashtra was supposed to be like a father figure. He was expected to be above this. So Duryodhana doing some wrong things, that's not right, but it is understandable, it's expected, because they are rivals. But Dhritarashtra consenting to that, Dhritarashtra never objecting to that, that is wrong. So the Pandavas treated Dhritarashtra like a father figure, but Dhritarashtra never treated them like sons. So he became, because of his attachment to Duryodhana, he became desensitized. So it all started, I'll talk about Duryodhana's envy and how it started when we talk about Duryodhana later. But here, let's focus on this theme, that the inner screen metaphor, that based on our attachments, our consciousness just goes towards certain things. And other things, we become deadened to them. We become blinded to them. So in the case of Dhritarashtra, the first direct nefarious plan that was made was that when the Pandavas came to the kingdom, because they were so courteous, so polite, they started winning the hearts of the courtiers and the citizens. And the Duryodhana started becoming more and more envious. So then Duryodhana said, send the Pandavas away. He said, as long as the Pandavas are there, then whatever I do, I cannot attract people. It's like, suppose there's a cricket team in which there's one player is a superstar. The other player is also a star. But as long as the superstar is there, nobody pays attention to the star. So if the superstar is not playing, then the star, he also plays nicely. Yeah, he's doing well. He's taking our team to victory. So the Pandavas had become like superstars. So he said, get them out. So he said, but how can you send them? He said, no, you can send them to Varnavart. He said, that was In that time there were kingdoms, and in the kingdom there were provinces. So some kingdoms, some provinces, they had their own administration, and the Pandavas would occasionally go. The Kurus would occasionally visit there. Some they would directly administer, like say the capital city or the the government would directly administer, and others there may be different states who administer. So he said that in Varanava there is going to be a big festival, and you send the Pandavas there. And he says, so Dhritarashtra said that if they go there, how can I send them there just like that? They will become suspicious I am sending them away. And even if they go there, they will come back. Duryodhana said, no. If they go there, they don't need to ever come back. And he did not speak anything. Now, Dhritarashtra was born in a Kshatriya dynasty. And Kshatriyas, they live in an atmosphere of political intrigue. Now, where there is power, then there are always the possibility of conspiracy, because of which someone may try to grab power. So when Duryodhana said this, Dhritarashtra understood it. The Pandavas may never come back. He didn't ever come back. That means he understood the plan afoot to kill the Pandavas. So he did not try to stop Duryodhana. He just remained silent. And not only did he remain silent, but going beyond that, he participated in the scheme. He said, okay, for the next few days, I will ask some of the courtiers to speak in praise of the festival in Varanavat. And as they keep speaking in praise, the Pandavas' curiosity will be aroused. And once the curiosity is aroused, then when I tell them to go, they will naturally go. So Prabhupada writes in one purport that, you know, we are meant to use our intelligence to control our enjoying mentality. But our problem is we are habituated to enjoying intelligently. That means, enjoying intelligently means that we use our intelligence to find out how I can enjoy and how I can get away with enjoying. So I saw one cartoon as a traffic cop had caught a person for speeding. He says, did you not see the speed limit? He said, I saw the speed limit, I just didn't see you. So the idea is that doing the wrong thing is not the problem. Getting caught while doing the wrong thing is the problem. So, if I can be clever enough to do the wrong and get away with it, then there's no problem. So, in this case, the intelligence gets used to do the wrong in such a way that it is covered up. So, Dhritarashtra participated in the conspiracy. He did not scheme to directly set the Pandavas to fire, but he participated in it. There's practically no occasion where Dhritarashtra put his foot down out of any concern for the Pandavas. So how can it be that a person, even if there's an extended family, they're nephews, they're his own, they're in a sense his own blood, his brother's blood, his own blood. So how can somebody get so desensitized that there's a plan to kill them? And he goes along with that plan. So exactly what was planned happened. They glorified the Varanavat ceremony for some time, the festival that was going to be held. And then he says, you know, as representatives of our kingdom, of the Kurus, you can go, Pandavas can go there. Now, this is a very enjoyable festival. You can go and enjoy. Now, Yudhishthir was very virtuous. But at the same time, he was not naive. Yudhishthir immediately got the question, if it is so enjoyable, then why is Duryodhana not being sent? Isn't it? So he knew something must be fishy over here. So therefore, what he did was, he said, Yudhishthir, you know, he has his intelligence. In traditional culture, generally the elders are to be obeyed. And sometimes the elders may tell us to do something wrong. So then how to respond to that, that is a difficult situation. But in this case, he felt that, okay, if they want us to go, let me go. But Vidura warned them. And I'm not going to go into the full story here. I'm going to focus on Dhritarashtra's character. So I'll talk two incidents in this session, and then we'll talk two incidents in the next session, when I'll again talk about Dhritarashtra a little bit more. But at this point, he consented to a scheme to kill his own nephews. Then the Pandavas went in the forest, they survived, they went to the Varanava, they survived the fire, and eventually they got the hand of Draupadi. Now, by getting the hand of Draupadi, they became allied with a very powerful kingdom. At that time, there were two main kingdoms. There was the Panchala kingdom and the Kuru kingdom. Krishna was of course there in Dwarka, but Krishna did not, the Dwarkavasis did not focus so much on the local conflict issues so much. So the two main kingdoms were the Panchala and Drupada, Panchala and Kuru. So they were rivals, but at the same time they were friends also. So now once the Pandavas were allied with Drupada, then he knew, Dhritarashtra knew that the Pandavas would, even the Pandavas would not demand their rights, Drupada would demand the Pandavas' rights. And Drupada could not be rejected. Drupada is in the same generation as Dhritarashtra, and Drupada is also nearly as powerful as the Pandavas. Now, along with this, also when the Varanavat, the house of Lakh was burnt, at that time, the people in general already had become suspicious. Why were the Pandavas sent away? And they were sent away and they were burnt. So they started blaming the royal family for this. And when it was discovered that, okay, the Pandavas have married Draupadi, then Bhishma came to Dhritarashtra. And Bhishma said, O king, Dhritarashtra had become temporarily the caretaker king after Pandu had abdicated the throne. So he said, O king, ever since the Pandavas have been burned, the Pandavas were reputed to be burned in the forest, in the fire, citizens are criticizing us. They are blaming us for having killed Pandu's sons. I feel so ashamed that I cannot go out in public to show my face. So it is because of great fortune that the Pandavas are still alive. Now, O king, it is an opportunity for you to win back the trust of the Pandavas, to redeem the good name of the Kuru king. Call back the Pandavas and give them half of the kingdom. Now Dhritarashtra thought about this. He would have loved nothing more than for his son to have the whole kingdom. Actually, the question was whether his son deserved even half of the kingdom. But now it is understood half kingdom at least he can keep. But he just didn't want to give that kingdom at all. But then he realized what Bhishma was saying was true. So when he called back the Pandavas, he called them back not out of any affection. Not that it's like, oh, we thought you had died, you're alive. Oh, you're still alive? It was that attitude. So he called them back and he pretended to be affectionate to them. But there is the letter of the law and there is the spirit of the law. So in the letter of the law, okay, divide the kingdom into two. He called the Pandavas back and he said, it's fortunate that you have won the hand of Draupadi. And now, it's fortunate that you have survived the forest. And I give you half the kingdom. But half the kingdom that he gave was Khandava. The Khandava was a complete forested area. There was nothing over there. It's like suppose they're a parent and they have two children. And they have one bread. Half of the bread is rotten, half of the bread is good. and they divide the bread into half. I'm giving both of you half. But one child, they give the full, the fresh bread, and the other half, they give the rotten bread. Or if a patriarch in a family has two companies, and one is flourishing and the other is almost bankrupt. He says, let's divide, you will get one company, you will get one company. In terms of letter, both of them are given equal. But in terms of actuality, it's not at all equal at all. So, although he in word agreed to Bhishma's suggestion, in letter he agreed, but in spirit he didn't agree. Somehow, the Pandavas worked in such a way that by Krishna's arrangement, Khandavaprastha became Indraprastha. So here also we see before that, this sense of fairness was no longer there. He was doing this for external show. It's to show the king, then I am fair. But actually he had no affection left for the Pandavas. Sometimes some people say that if we become too attached, or if we become too detached, if we become too renounced, then we'll become hard-hearted, we'll become uncaring of our loved ones. Yes, it is possible that sometimes detachment may lead to hard-heartedness, but a far more likely probability is that attachment will lead to hard-heartedness. When we become attached to something, all our emotions get concentrated in that one thing. And then we become desensitized to everything else. So the attachment of Dhritarashtra to his son was such that he became desensitized and hard-hearted to his nephews. So that's why it is more often than not attachment that will make us hard-hearted to everything apart from the object of attachment. And probably his worst moment, Dhritarashtra's worst moment, when he acted most nefariously by not acting, was in the Kuru assembly, was in the gambling match. The Kauravas had tried various ways to try to destroy the Pandavas. But when that didn't work, they decided that we will conspire and seize the kingdom. So when Dhritarashtra sent Vidura to call the Pandavas for a gambling match, at that time Vidura himself vehemently protested. He says, if the Pandavas and Kauravas gamble, already there are tension between them. If they gamble, they will surely fight. Yudhishthir also felt, why should we gamble? He was very reluctant to gamble. And even when the gambling match actually took place, Dhritarashtra remained silent when the match was rigged. See, the match was rigged because the normal rule of gambling is that whoever is gambling, they stake the money and they play that, they roll the dice. It's like, say, two kids, they have some quarrel and they say, okay, let's have a boxing match. And the two kids come for boxing, and when the actual boxing match starts, one kid, instead of being there, brings Mike Tyson over there and he's going to fight on behalf of me. That's completely unfair. The fight is between the two of them. So Shakuni was a gamester. He was a professional gambler. So now Duryodhana said that, I will put the money, because Shakuni was not that wealthy. The Pandavas and Kauravas were phenomenally wealthy. He said, I will take the money and he will roll the dice. So Yudhishthir said, that is against the rules of gambling. But he looked at Dhritarashtra, and Dhritarashtra remained silent. And Duryodhana simply jeered the Dhritarashtra. If you are afraid to gamble, then there's no need to gamble. Now for a Kshatriya to be accused of being afraid of something, that is an unbearable slur. And he goaded him to fight. And then as this fight went on and on, actually the Pandavas lost everything. And then Yudhishthira, throughout all he was thinking, he was thinking that I have my brothers, I have my wife, I have to take care of them. I have lost everything. Somehow I have to get it back. And he's taking one more thing, thinking that I'll get it all back. And eventually he takes Draupadi. And when Draupadi was lost, I'll talk about the psychology which led to Draupadi being disrobed. What was the thinking of Duryodhana and Karna? I'll talk about it later. And the ethics of this issue we'll also talk in the next session. But here, when Draupadi was dragged into the assembly, and at that time the attempt was made to dishonor her publicly by disrobing her. This was outrageous. And for Dhritarashtra to remain silent at this time was unconscionable. Bhishma opposed, Vidurashtra vehemently opposed it. But Dhritarashtra remained silent. And even after Krishna miraculously intervened, and he protected Draupadi's chastity, still Duryodhana did not give up his animosity. He said that somehow something happened, this plan didn't work. He said that Draupadi is our maid, now take her to our rooms and she will have to clean our rooms now. And Dushasana started dragging her there. At that time Vidura spoke to Dhritarashtra and he told, oh king, I can see unbearable inauspiciousness happening everywhere. And then he told him, at that time all the kings would have some their own fire, small fire, which is like a sacrificial fire, and they would keep oblations in that. That was considered to be auspicious. Like say some of us may have some incense sticks which we keep burning in the house. Like that, they would have sacrificial fire. And Vidura told Dhritarashtra that this sacrificial fire which you have kept lit throughout your life, that has got extinguished. When Dhritarashtra heard it, he became alarmed. He became alarmed and he said, what is this? Things have gone too far. And then he tried to make up. He tried to make up, and what did he say? He said, actually I had called this gambling match just to test your gambling skills. Well, if Duryodhana was not playing, how is the gambling skills being tested at all? Isn't it? It is like he just speaks one lie after one lie over there to try to cover up. But he says, anyway, he says, oh Draupadi, you have stuck to dharma, although you have been severely tested. You are glorious. Please ask for some benedictions. And then Draupadi says that, you know, release Yudhishthira from slavery. And he says, yes, ask for something more. He says that, release all my husbands with their weapons. I don't want anything more, because with their weapons they can regain everything else. So then he said, ask for something more. He says, no, a Kshatriya woman is said, it is said in ancient tradition that a Kshatriya woman should never ask for more than two benedictions. So this is what I'll ask for. He says, I'm not satisfied, I'll give you everything back. And actually, everything the Pandavas had lost, Dhritarashtra gave it back. This was his one act of, you could say, virtue. But it was not impelled by virtue, it was impelled by fear. But still, what happens? There is knowledge which is like light. And there is knowledge which is like lightning. Lightning illumines for a few moments, but as soon as the lightning ends, everything becomes dark. So for Dhritarashtra, this moment of virtue was like a lightning. It was there for a few moments, but after that, when the Pandavas went back with their kingdom, Duryodhana went to Shakuni and he said, you know, the old man has spoiled everything. We worked so hard. He said, yes. Shakuni went and Shakuni told him, you know, you have to, the Pandavas have become our enemies now. You have to go back. So then, Duryodhana went to Dhritarashtra and he said, oh father, what have you done? The Pandavas have taken vows to kill all of us. Do you think they will forget the insults that have been done to their wife just because you have given the kingdom back? He says, they will not rest in peace unless they kill us. Bhima had taken a vow that I'll break Duryodhana's thigh. He had taken a vow that I will break Dushasana's arm. So all those fierce vows he reminded him and he says, now again, his moral sense, his ethical sense which had been activated at some point, it again became obscured because of his attachment to Duryodhana. He says, oh, Duryodhana is in danger, Duryodhana may be killed by Bhima. He says, what do you know? What to do? He says, call the Pandavas back. Call the Pandavas back. And after calling the Pandavas back, let us ask them for another gambling match. So now, what, another gambling match? This is the only way. With this gambling match, we can save ourselves. And then the Pandavas had gone, he called them back for the gambling match. And in this gambling match, the stakes were that whoever loses, they will go to the forest. And predictably, Yudhishthira lost. So, he allowed a terrible bad thing to happen. He undid it, but he couldn't undo it. Because he redid the whole thing. That is the nature of attachment. Even if sometimes our sense of right or wrong dawns for some time, but the attachment is so great that that sense gets overshadowed. Sometimes if somebody is very attached, some people are alcoholic. When they are sober, they say, you know, I've done terrible things. I'm going to give up this alcohol now. I've caused so much trouble to my family. I've done this, I've done that. I'm going to give it up. But if that attachment to alcohol is so strong, after some time, say, again, forget it. I'm going to do this, whatever it is. So the attachment is something which will keep propositioning us. And saying no one time is not enough. One has to say no repeatedly. But and if that no is said because of some external pressure, the no will not last. If the no is said because of some internal determination, that is alone when it will last. So in his case, he acted against Duryodhana's plan when he gave the Pandavas the kingdom back. But that was simply out of fear. Oh, the sacrificial fire has stopped. What inauspiciousness will happen? Such inauspicious will not happen. Let me give the Pandavas the kingdom back. But then when he was told, oh, the Pandavas may kill your son, kill Duryodhana, they may take revenge. Then again, what happened was, again, Duryodhana just resurfaced in his, Duryodhana's protection, Duryodhana's well-being. And he just gave up his moral sense completely. So all the wrong he had done, he undid it, but he redid it again. So if there is a change to happen, that change always has to happen inside out. Change cannot be outside in. We'll talk about how in the next session, about how Dhritarashtra eventually changed. Now, outside in means what? From outside, some stimulus may come. And we all need some outside stimulus. But we cannot be dependent on the outside stimulus. The outside stimulus has to be internalized. Only when it is internalized, then we will be able to sustain the change. If the outside stimulus is the only stimulus, then as soon as some other outside stimulus comes, we will be pressured by that. So, we may all be inspired to change by something external, which is good. We all need inspiration. But that inspiration has to be eventually internalized. Now, there is inspiration and there is dedication. In inspiration, generally the feelings come before the actions. I feel like doing this. That's feelings come before the action. That's inspiration. But in dedication, the actions come before the feeling. When I am dedicated to doing something, whether I feel like it or I don't feel like it, I am going to do it. So, in the case of Duryodhana, in the case of Dhritarashtra, it was external impetus. So, that made him do that for one moment, but not for long. Because he never internalized any concern for the Pandavas. He never internalized a sense of morality or fairness. And that's how he again had the Pandavas called for a gambling match, and the disaster happened therein. That was the time when you could say more or less the Kauravas' fate was sealed. Actually, the Kauravas' fate was sealed when they tried to dishonor Draupadi itself. But still, Dhritarashtra tried to undo it, but again he redid the same thing. Jananapya atmanohitam karoti bhuyo vivashah prayashchitamatho katham. The Bhagavatam says, like an elephant may go and bathe in a river, but then the elephant comes out and sprinkles dirt on its own body. So similarly, if we are attached, we may give up some wrongdoing, but then again we do it again. Because we give up simply because of some external impetus, not because of internal intention. So how that intention is internalized in Dhritarashtra's case and how we may be able to internalize in our situation, we will discuss in our next session. I'll summarize here and we can have some questions. So I talked about how we did the character analysis of Dhritarashtra, and in this I talked about how wrongdoing is not just the wrong that we do, it is also the right that we don't do. And Dhritarashtra, he was so attached to Duryodhana that although right from birth Duryodhana was inauspicious, but he could have had 99 sons, but he wanted this one son. And because of that, he brought disaster on the whole Kuru dynasty. So when Duryodhana although he was meant to be like a father figure, but the attachment to Duryodhana so filled his mind that it left no space for concern for the Pandavas. What to speak of parental concern, it is not even human concern. Let them be killed. And he remained silent. So when the Kauravas made a plan, Duryodhana made a plan to burn the Pandavas alive, he just went along with it. And even when he gave the Pandavas the kingdom back, half of the kingdom, he did it in the letter, but not in spirit. And that's why he gave them a completely barren part of the kingdom. And eventually, even when he did give the gambling match, he gave the Pandavas back what they had lost. But that was also just because of the fear of inauspiciousness. When the fear of Duryodhana came in, then Duryodhana's well-being, again he went back and undid the whole thing. So when we become attached to something or someone, that object of attachment gets power to control us. And then even if we do the right thing, we'll do it only as long as it doesn't threaten the object of attachment. And even our knowledge that we get, even the resolutions that we make, they'll only be temporary. It's like light, not light, but like lightning. So if we are to change, then sometimes external pressure may begin the process of changing, giving up attachment. But unless we internalize, make it our own intention, it will not be sustained. So that applies not just up to giving up something wrong, but also taking up something right. So inspiration is when we feel like I should do it, and the feelings come and the action follow thereafter. Feelings come first and actions follow thereafter. But dedication means even if the feeling is not there, first the action will be there and then the feeling will come eventually. So Dhritarashtra demonstrates how attachment can completely desensitize a person so that they become brutally inhuman towards others, or at least they allow inhuman actions towards others to go on. And how he changed, we'll discuss in our next session. So any questions? Either about this session or about the previous session? Yes. I think you can speak. It's not a very big assembly. Mic can come, but even if the mic doesn't come, I'll repeat the question.
Thank you very much, sir. I'm just wondering that in our devotional service, how can the inspiration and dedication help us?
Okay. In devotional service, how can inspiration and dedication help us? In general, it is that we all have to, we all need inspiration. That means we all have to find out maybe particular activities in bhakti which we can also connect with at an emotional level, which we like. So we like to hear the classes of a particular devotee, or we like to read a particular book. We worship the deities, but we may like a particular dress of the deities. We may like particular deities. And that means when we say we like, it simply means that our thoughts and our emotions flow in that direction very easily. When we like something, we don't have to put an effort to do it. I like it, we'll naturally do it. So, in bhakti, if we consider bhakti to be like a big circle, there'll be some activities in bhakti which we like to do. And we need to find those out. And we do them regularly so that we have that our emotions are also working for us within bhakti. But at the same time, we cannot do only those activities. We also have to do other things. So the other thing that we need to do at that time, we may not feel like doing it. Some of us may like kirtans, but we may not like japa. Some of us may like katha, but may not like philosophy. Some of us may like deity worship, but may not like some other service. But then we have to see, if this is also a part of my bhakti, then I should be ready to do it. And when there are things which we don't like to do, or we don't like in the sense, not that we dislike them, but we just don't like them so much, then we need dedication at that time. So in general in our life, beyond bhakti also, there are some things which we like to do and some things which we don't like to do. So if we do only the things which we like to do, we will not be responsible. Because sometimes responsibility requires us to do things which we don't like. But at the same time, if we have too many things which we don't like to do, then we just feel burdened. You know, our emotions will be constantly working against us, they will be tormenting us, and we'll feel choked. So we need to get strength from certain activities which we like to do, and then use that strength to do the activity that we don't like to do. So if we manage this balance, then we will be able to persevere. And over a period of, so if we find out what is it that inspires me, and we at one level we can be looking for inspiration. Okay, this, you know, this really inspires me, I want to do this. So if we like a particular dress of the deities, and we keep those pictures in our phone, we look at those deities, pray to those deities, our emotions, our bhav, bhakti bhav, naturally comes when we look at those deities dressed in that way, or decorated in that way, or those particular deities, that's nice. But that doesn't mean if there are other deities, we'll not even look at them, we'll not bow to them. We will. We'll offer our respects, we'll offer our worship. So we need inspiration, but we also need dedication. And the balance of both will bring steadiness in our bhakti. We can't rely only on dedication, but we can't rely only on inspiration either. Because our feelings are not always reliable. There's a famous author, he was asked, do you write only when you are inspired, or do you write every day? So he said, I write only when I'm inspired, and I make sure that I'm inspired every morning at 9 o'clock. So what he meant is that, you know, we can't just rely on inspiration or arbitrary. We have a schedule, we start writing, and the author starts writing, and sometimes ideas come, sometimes ideas don't come, but gradually we keep writing, things will, the one gets into the flow sooner or later. But if one doesn't write at all, then one will not be a writer at all. So they say that if you just keep waiting for inspiration, I'm a writer, so I read a little bit of writing. Is if you keep waiting for inspiration, you are not a writer, you are a waiter. So similarly, whatever activity which we know we need to do in life, we can't be simply waiters. You know, we have to start doing it. Okay? Thank you. Hare Krishna. Any other questions? Yes, please. Yeah.
We see also in chapter 1 of Bhagavad Gita, we see that Prabhupada speaks about ordinary soft-heartedness,
yeah,
being attached. So how are we to understand that? And I guess the other part of the question is that do we also understand that ordinary are lucky because in the presence of Krishna, he internalizes his intention? Or
like, you know, what happens for the rest of the people, as it was just pure lucky? Okay. So the question is that we see that Prabhupada also talks about at one level Dhritarashtra's attachment, and he also talks about say Arjuna being soft-hearted. Now, you will see that in the first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada speaks about Arjuna quite positively. He's so soft-hearted, he's so thoughtful, he's thinking before acting, he's very fit for enlightenment. And the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada starts saying that he's in tears. Tears are a sign of ignorance, they're a sign of material attachment. And everybody in this material world is suffering from the skin disease. And we have to give up the skin disease. So it's almost like a complete change of tone. So the idea is, Acharyas have explained that the first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita is meant to convey how Arjuna is fit for enlightenment. So the first chapter demonstrates Arjuna's qualification for enlightenment, that he is a person who is thoughtful, although his thoughts may not be going in the right direction at that time. He may be giving wrong reasons, but at least he is considering the consequences of his actions before acting. So in that sense, he is thoughtful and thus he is ready for enlightenment. But in the second chapter, once the process of enlightenment begins, you say, okay, your current understanding is wrong. It's just like you have before a student enters a school. I have said there's an Ivy League or top university somewhere. Then there are exams. The student clears the exams. Oh, you're qualified to come to the school. But then once the student comes to that school, the student is going to start at the bottom rank in that school. Because the student doesn't know, he just entered into a school. So then you say, okay, you don't think you know too much. Now you start from the basics. So in the second chapter, Prabhupada, Krishna is starting from the basics like that for Arjuna. So when we look at great characters such as the Pandavas or the associates of the Lord, we don't have to go too much into who is right and who is wrong. We focus more on what is to be learned. So sometimes soft-heartedness can also be a weakness if that makes us too sentimental. But if soft-heartedness helps us to be sensitive to others, it's one thing to have sentiments, which is good. It's another thing to be sentimental. To be sentimental means to be driven by sentiments alone. To have sentiments means to know that, okay, people also have emotions and I have to consider their emotions. I also have emotions, I have to consider my emotions. So to not consider emotions is wrong, because we are all emotional creatures. But to consider only emotions and nothing else, that is also wrong. Say a doctor is going to do surgery. The patient is going to have some pain. The child is going to have to be afraid, be fearful, be in pain. Now the doctor has to be aware of that. And the doctor may speak some words to pacify the child, to comfort the child, maybe give some toffees, give some toys. Make sure that the child feels good. This doctor is a nice person. So the doctor has to consider the feelings of the child and allay those feelings as much as possible. But at the same time, a doctor cannot say, the child is so scared, I will not do the surgery. How can I cause pain to the child? If the surgery is required, it has to be done. But just because the surgery has to be done, that doesn't mean the doctor don't care about the feelings at all. So even when surgery is to be done, the doctors usually give anesthesia, give some pain medicine after the surgery. So they consider the effect on the patient also. So that way, we should be soft-hearted, so that we are aware of the emotional side of the situation. But we should not be so soft-hearted as to be sentimental. That means to be driven only by the emotions. Does that answer your question?
So we shouldn't be going to any of the directions, like so soft-hearted or so hard-hearted.
Yes. To be completely unemotional is not good, and to be only emotional is also not good. Okay. Yeah. Any other questions or comments? Yes. So is the soul dormant right now? The soul is dormant, and who sanctions the free will? Actually, the soul is dormant in one particular sense, and that is that a soul is not spiritually active. I give the example of the video game, a child watching a video game, or say watching a horror movie. The child's consciousness is completely caught in whatever is going on that screen, and the child is not aware of anything else. Now this does not mean that the child is not doing anything. A child is clicking this button, okay, let this car go this way, let this weapon go this way, let this go here, let this go there. What is happening? The child is active in the video game, but the child is not active in the physical world. So like that, the soul from the spiritual perspective is inactive. But within this world of body and mind, the soul is active. So without the soul accepting the option, the mind may propose, but it is the soul who accepts the proposal. So the mind, we could say, is the generator of the ideas. The intelligence is the evaluator of ideas. But it is the soul that is the selector. So the mind will say, okay, why not do this? Why not eat this? Why not watch this? Why not go here? The intelligence will say, this is too expensive. I don't have time for this. But sometimes the intelligence is weak, let's go there. The intelligence, that means the mind's voice is one thing, intelligence voice is another thing. But it's the soul who chooses what to hear. That's why the soul is vital. And without the soul, nothing will happen. But the soul, I wouldn't say the soul is a sanctioner. The sanctioning is the role of the super soul. The soul is the selector. The soul gives the final decision. This is what I want to do, this is what I don't want to do. Now, whether the soul will be able to do it or not, even if somebody decides, I want to drink, the desire comes within, why not drink? And the intelligence says, no, one drink will mean one too many, you will relapse. No, it will be only one, I'm going to drink now. Okay, let's drink. So the mind said, let's drink. The intelligence said, no. The soul said, let's drink. Now they may go along, and when they go along, at that time there may be a traffic jam and they may not get to the bar only. May not be able to drink. So whether, even after the soul desires to do something, decides to do something, whether the soul is able to do that or not, that depends on many other factors. And those factors are sanctioned by the super soul. So the super soul is the sanctioner, the soul is the selector. Okay? Thank you. Yes? Okay. So if we pray very sincerely to Krishna that we become freed from some conditionings, so will he help? See, Krishna certainly listens to our prayers and Krishna certainly helps. But exactly how he helps, that will vary. Because if we look at it from a more psychological perspective, the mind is a reality of its own. The body is a reality of its own. So if I have a fracture, if I pray to Krishna, Krishna, no, please heal this fracture. Will Krishna do that? Well, in principle, Krishna can do anything. In practice, a devotee doesn't demand from Krishna to perform some miracles for him. In the normal way is, okay, you got a fracture, okay, do an operation or dress the arm and let the body heal on its own. So we don't expect Krishna to interfere with the process of nature. Similarly, with respect to our conditionings, just as the fracture is a physical reality, the impressions on the mind are also a reality, although subtle reality. So, now will they change automatically by the practice of bhakti or by a prayer to Krishna? It depends. So many devotees have the experience that they start chanting Hare Krishna and many of the bad habits fall away. It does happen. And at one level, it is the potency of the chanting, it is the potency of Krishna bhakti. But at another level, it could be some other thing also. It means, rather than saying it is another thing, for some people, some other things may be going on. You know, I know a devotee who has been practicing bhakti for 25 years. So I just can't give up smoking. He said, now, is it the chanting is not working? Can we really say that the devotee is not sincere in chanting? Well, it's very difficult to say who is sincere and who is not sincere. We have to go into, we can't go into anyone's heart to make a statement about anyone's sincerity. But what we can say is that all of us have certain habits and those habits serve certain needs. Let's consider, say, drinking. Now, some people are social drinkers. It's not that they themselves are very fond of drinking. It's just that they feel that drinking is essential to belong to the social group I am in. And if everybody else drinks and I am the odd person out, it will not be proper, so I drink. But then, if their social circle changes, their drinking stops. Because for them, drinking was not a need of theirs. It was just a social circumstantial need. But say for somebody, drinking is their escape way from distress or stress. As soon as they feel stressed or distressed, okay, drink, I'll feel good. Now, if they come to bhakti, at that time, in bhakti also there is stress. Sometimes in bhakti also there is distress. Now, unless they find a healthier way to deal with that stress or distress, they find a escape way, say, within bhakti. Not exactly escape way. It's a way to gain relief. Maybe through intense chanting, through absorption, kirtan, or whatever it is. Unless they find a healthier way to serve that need. The need is relief. And that need is a healthy need. It is a normal human need. So often our bad habits, our cravings are simply unhealthy expressions of healthy needs. They are unhealthy expressions. Drinking is an unhealthy activity. But the healthy need is a need for relief. It's a normal human need. So now, when that unhealthy expression is artificially curbed by willpower, don't do it. But the healthy need is there, and unless that need is addressed, that unhealthy expression will come back again. Sometimes when a habit is very deep rooted within us, we have to check, okay, what need of mine is this habit serving? And how can I serve that need in a healthier way? So sometimes when we pray to Krishna, Krishna, just please free me from this conditioning. Yes, that prayer is good, but if it doesn't seem to be working and we are still falling prey to the conditioning, that doesn't mean that Krishna is not helping. Krishna may help us by giving us the intelligence to understand ourselves better through that habit. Okay, what is my need? So, if we go deeper, introspect and understand our need, and then we address that need in a healthy way, the intelligence to address that need in a healthy way, that is also coming from Krishna. And once we use that gift of Krishna, then the gift that we want, freedom from that habit, freedom from that condition, that will come. So sometimes Krishna may not give us, say, I am very hungry and I want food. Now somebody may not give me food, somebody give me the ingredients. And then I said, I want a chapati, I give you a flour. But I didn't get chapati. You got a flour, you make the chapati now. So sometimes we ask for chapati, but Krishna may give us flour. That means we ask Krishna, please free me from this conditioning. But Krishna may give us the intelligence to understand what is happening with us. Why is this conditioning there for us? And that is like giving the flour. So then we have to use our intelligence to cook with the flour and make the chapati. So we have to use the intelligence to serve our need in a healthy way. And once we do that, then we will become free from that habit. Or sometimes it may be that Krishna may allow that conditioning to go on for some time, because through that we may learn humility. We may think that even when you are practicing bhakti, you may think, you know, if I apply my willpower, whatever I decide, I can do it. Yes, I have this conditioning, I have now decided, I am going to give it up. So bhakti is very subtle, because sometimes we may give up some conditioning, but that may make us proud. And in a sense, if we consider there is the war, we could say there is the battle against temptation. And there is the war for devotion. The battle against temptation is one battle within the bigger war for devotion. Our purpose is not just to give up the bad things, become free from temptations, give up bad habits. Our purpose ultimately is to love Krishna. So, if I am fighting a particular battle against temptation, you know, I want to give this up. I may win that battle, but if that makes me proud, I think I am so self-controlled, I have such willpower, then basically the implication is, why do I need Krishna? Then I am losing in the war for devotion. If somebody decides, I am going to fast Nirjal on Ekadashi, great determination, they fast. But then while fasting, they go to the kitchen and see who is eating what. know, this person so attached, this person sense gratifier, this person glutton. Then their body is fasting, but their ego is feasting. So, if that is happening, then they may win the battle against temptation by succeeding in the fast. But they will lose the war for devotion because they have not gone closer to Krishna by that. So sometimes, if the conditioning stays on and doesn't go away, Krishna may want us to learn humility through this. And I am not that self-controlled a person. So then we take a humble position and try to keep practicing bhakti with that conditioning. That, okay, no conditioning can stop us from practicing bhakti. In bhakti, we may be unqualified, but we are never disqualified. We'll be unqualified, you know, okay, I'm fallen like this, I have this conditioning, I have that conditioning. But Krishna never says, because you have conditioning, you can't practice bhakti. Whatever be a situation, we still can still keep practicing bhakti. So then, having the humility to accept, you know, I can't give up this conditioning right now. Despite my efforts, this is still there. But even if I can't give it up, I will keep practicing bhakti. So that requires humility. Because sometimes we may practice bhakti and we want to have get some prestige in a devotional circle through the practice of bhakti. Now just see how renounced I am. Just see how self-controlled I am. We may not get that prestige, but still we may get the devotion if we can cultivate the humility. So yes, Krishna does help us when we pray to Him, but His help may come in various ways. And that's why we have to be open to see in what way Krishna is helping us. Okay? So thank you very much. We will, if you have any other questions, we'll continue in our future sessions. So Shri Prabhupada ki Hare Krishna. Thank you.
Hare Krishna.